Hello, I'm Ivan Berg, and this is my story. Part 2, 1945 to 1953. I was remarkably unaffected by the end of World War II. I was 9 years old, and there'd always been war. It was normal. Peace only meant that the streetlights came on and people no longer said, "Don't you know there's a war on?" as an excuse for almost anything. I think I was more concerned about the often non-arrival of my Captain Marvel and Superman American comics imported by a local newsagent. They were expensive and accounted for most of my pocket money. A little later on, I graduated to the UK-published The Champion, a mainly text weekly magazine for boys featuring my favourite character, Rockfist Rogan, a Spitfire pilot and champion boxer. At the Orchard Junior School in Wells Street, Hackney, I was taught by the comfortably built, nearly always wearing a floral dress, Mrs. Cottrell. Reading, writing and arithmetic, with a bit of geography and history thrown in, preparing for the 11 plus exam. We had a mock exam in the middle and at the end of every term. We even had what Mrs. Cottrell called surprise exams. Mrs. Cottrell cajoled, encouraged and otherwise motivated her charges. I don't remember any bad behaviour and I don't remember any of my classmates, but I did sail through the 11 plus. It was also the very last time that I can recall enjoying school. Bearing in mind my awful experience at Rowledge House, I was appalled at the age of 11 to be enrolled for Hebrew classes on Sunday mornings. Probably my mother's idea, as she was enthralled to her brother, and felt it would be letting the Joseph Halpern side down if I wasn't bar mitzvahed at 13. I hated the classes immediately. With my passion for cars, I do remember the horrible headmaster's car. It was a black Austin 12 saloon with a registration number EYE something. I think I maybe went 3 or 4 times before I got up the courage to truant. I also had to learn to lie convincingly to my parents. I mainly spent the 2-hour Sunday sessions watching the model boats on the model boat pond in nearby Victoria Park. It was a very successful subterfuge. It was also employed by my brother Michael some 10 years later. Michael was born whilst we were still living at 143 Victoria Park Road, and was the main reason we were shunted to the top of the housing list and allocated a prefab. A prefabricated rectangular bungalow built of asbestos cement panels nailed to a timber frame built on a bomb site in Danesdale Road, Hackney, off Victoria Park Road, and thus close to Victoria Park. I don't remember very much about the early post-war days. An Italian prisoner of war camp in Victoria Park, comprised of large Nissen huts and Italian prisoners of war wearing overalls with POW emblazoned on the back, working in teams, clearing bomb sites. Freezing cold winters with ice forming inside the prefab windows. Joining the Cub Scouts and lasting just one wet and dreary camping weekend. And reading, reading and reading. I mainly read non-fiction, cars, ships, planes, engines, electricity, anything that explained how things worked. I liked cutaway illustrations, in particular those of the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth transatlantic liners. I also developed a surprising expertise in recognising makes and models of cars. The prefab had, at least by the standards of those days, a modern fitted kitchen. There was an electric cooker, an electric wash boiler, lots of cupboard and drawer space, and wonder of wonders, a refrigerator. It had a solid fuel fireplace in the living room, with the coal kept in a coal shed, which was a kind of miniature Nissen hut made of curved sheets of corrugated iron bolted together with brick ends and an ill-fitting wooden door. Many's the freezing trip out of the kitchen door I made to fill the coal scuttle. At this point, I must apologise to my brother Michael for not remembering much about him other than sharing a bedroom and taking him on the crossbar of my bike to the Childminder in Caslon Road on my way to school. I think he must have been around 3 years old then, so that would have been in 1949. Why the Childminder? My mother was having one of her regular spells in a mental hospital. Michael may correct me on this, but our mother seemed to be away for a lot of the time in the late 1940s. My father had to work. He was a ladies' couture tailor in London's West End, and keep house and look after us and visit our mother at the weekends. I think I did some shopping, took the washing to the laundry, but otherwise I wasn't of much help, though thinking about it, I must have done a lot of babysitting. I said earlier that I sailed through the 11-plus examination. This got me to grammar school. There were choices. Parmiters didn't like the uniform, although that's where Michael eventually went. City of London, too far, too posh, and the Grocer's Company School. I liked the grocer's tie and the blazer badge, so it got chosen. Then began my downward path. Year 1, Form 1A. Year 2, 2B. Year 3, 3C. Year 4, 4D. I was bored. I truanted. The headmaster was one T.O. Bulk, who thought my essays showed promise and once told my parents that I would make a good barrister. Although my preferred future career, according to one of my end-of-term essays, was that of brain surgeon. I enjoyed woodwork and, with the encouragement of the teacher, designed and built a fairly large wooden model speedboat. I carved it out of a lump of solid hardwood. It was very heavy, and I could never find a model electric motor powerful enough to propel it. I gave up in the end after trying my wind-up gramophone clockwork motor. It was a devil of a job to put it back into the gramophone. It did get me interested in clockwork mechanisms and how they worked. I took a few clocks to bits, including a rather nice mantelpiece clock. I had bits left over from that. Curiously enough, it still worked, though the chimes had stopped. I had to throw the bits left over away to be sure not to be found out. I suppose this experience got me interested in precision instrument making as something to do when I left school. I got out of being bar mitzvahed at 13 quite easily. When my parents went to the synagogue to talk about the event, the rabbi didn't know who I was. My truanting had been that successful. I obviously could not be prepared for bar mitzvah in the time available, and anyway, I wanted no part of it. It upset my mother, and I was secretly gleeful when I was told that the Reverend Joseph Halpern was dismayed. What did I actually learn at grammar school? Well, I was unable to master the apostrophe. The novel I wrote at 19 displays this in spades. But I enjoyed writing, suffered arithmetic and geometry, and hated algebra, as it made no sense to me. This is puzzling, as over 30 years later, with a bit of initial help from Michael, I was able to master the basic computer language, which uses a lot of algebra. I learned some German, some French and some Spanish. History and geography were okay. I also sang in the school choir until my voice broke. Many pleasanting, truanting afternoons were spent in West End newsreel cinemas, which showed Gaumont British or Pathé News for a few minutes and filled the rest of the hourly performances with Looney Tunes, that is, Tom and Jerry, etc., cartoons. They were popular truanting venues for teenage boys and, needless to say, attracted homosexuals carrying raincoats as bears to honey. The technique was always the same. Sit next to a boy in the nearly always almost empty theatre, throw the raincoat over both laps, and for starters, place hand on boy's thigh. At this point, I would move several seats away. If the man with the Mac persisted, I would leave the theatre, not being brave enough to confront the guy or make a fuss. Then it was off to Leicester Square and the American-style 40s milk bar to spend the rest of my pocket money on an ice cream soda. There were usually a few girls at the bar, hoping to be picked up by a Yank. I started to read fiction. I was at the local library at least once a week, and we also had a visiting private library, mainly used by my father. It was a motorised tricycle, propelling a very large box that opened up to display the books. I read C.S. Forrester, Captain Marryat, Herman Melville, Conrad and Jack London, Raphael Sabatini's short story collection, A Century of Sea Stories, was a particular favourite, and Christopher Isherwood's I Am a Camera for the sexy bits. I also read Hemingway, Steinbeck and Caldwell. I don't know why, but my father was a great fan of Frank G. Slaughter, a not very famous but very prolific American doctor and novelist who wrote historical sea stories featuring surgeons and surgical techniques that were always described in very gory detail. You could learn a great deal about bloody and excruciatingly painful surgery by reading Mr. Slaughter. I picked up the Slaughter books after my father had read them and often had to read very quickly to be sure to finish before the tricycle librarian came to collect. So I wasn't bar mitzvahed. I was bored at school. I truanted, I forged parental excuse notes, I had no friends. But I don't remember being particularly unhappy, I was always lost in a book. After demobilisation from the army, my father's younger brother, my Uncle Teddy, taught himself photography and bought an Ensign Commando camera, British made. I tried to persuade him to get hold of a black market Leica 35mm, but Teddy, like the rest of the family, refused to buy anything German. Teddy also bought one of the very first portable electronic flash units. It was made by Dawes Electronics and was large and very heavy. I think it incorporated a small 12-volt car battery that Teddy charged up overnight. It was good for 100 or so flashes a charge. Teddy thus became one of the first flash-equipped professional wedding and bar mitzvah photographers. I learned how to develop film, make contact prints, and use an enlarger. This inspired me to set up my own developing and printing business out of a cupboard in the prefab bedroom I shared with Michael. It was very primitive, using a blackout curtain draped over the cupboard's open doors. I did a deal with the local grocer, produced a hand-lettered notice board with prices and print samples, and waited for the mostly holiday snaps business. I started out just doing contact prints. I made enough money to justify the purchase of a second-hand enlarger. I did good business with postcard size enlargements, giving the grocer his cut, of course. I was eventually put out of business when the local chemist set up in competition. I suppose the punters felt it was more appropriate to take their films for development to the chemist where they bought the film, rather than a grocer. I still kept an interest in photography, and it came in handy quite a few times later on. I left school as quickly as I could at 15 years old without taking the General Certificate of Education exam. I must have been the despair of my parents. No qualifications, no future. What to do? You may recall my interest in taking clocks to bits and putting them back together. So, clockmaking then. But all the clockmakers were in Switzerland. Precision instruments then. I went for interview with famous precision instrument maker Negretti and Zambra and was taken on as an apprentice precision instrument maker. I made the tea, cleaned the workbenches, swept the floor, and watched the precision instrument makers at work. I left after 2 weeks. A neighbour and friend of my father came to the rescue. He worked for a wealthy entrepreneur who had decided to get into magazine publishing. He was about to start a magazine for the sport of speedway racing. It was called Speedway Star and was in need of a cub reporter. I was interviewed and, to my great delight, was taken on. I had to agree to go to Pitman's College in Southampton Row 1 day a week and 2 evenings to learn the shorthand and typing skills that were then deemed vital for journalists. I reported on a good few speedway races and dutifully attended Pitman's College. The classes were full of girls who wanted to be shorthand typists. I was the only boy in both the touch typing and shorthand classes, and it was very intimidating. Even worse, I could never read back my shorthand. I didn't last very long at Speedway Star. I stupidly repeated some gossip about the sex life of the magazine's accountant. We worked in the same office and he was constantly lauding the physical attributes of his fiancée and boasting how great the sex was. My indiscretion came to the attention of the big boss and I was called into his very large office and made to stand in front of his very large desk. The accountant was perched nervously on the edge of an armchair. I was scared stiff and admitted the offence. In retrospect, I should have lied, earned the respect of the boss for brazening it out, and kept the job. The last words from the boss were a very loud, "Get out!" After exaggerating my shorthand skills at interview, I often wonder why I wasn't tested, I then joined the South London Press, a local South London paper, a very long way away from Hackney in Streatham, again as a cub reporter. I didn't last long there either. I was standby court reporter, which I found very boring. And anyway, I couldn't read my notes, so I'm afraid I got a few of my facts wrong. After that, I gave up Pitman's College and shorthand and touch typing and reverted to the four-finger typing method that has stood me in reasonable stead ever since. Next up, dress design and cutting. Designers and cutters were, according to my father, always in demand and could always command high wages. His youngest brother Monty was cited as an example. Though Monty didn't design, he only cut. So reluctantly, I signed on to evening classes in dress design at St Martin's School of Art and was taken on by Uncle Monty's employer as some sort of assistant to Monty. I was rather good at sketching dresses, But after sketching dresses after dresses in the style demanded, I switched to the classes in advertising and found I was rather good at writing advertising copy. I applied for and got a 15-year-old boy's dream job. It was advertised on the St. Martin's notice board. Photographic assistant for Soho Studio. Knowledge of photography an advantage. The studio had the exclusive contract with the famous Windmill Theatre to photograph the Windmill Girls, on stage and off stage. The on-stage shots were set pieces in between burlesque-type comedy routines and sketches, where the girls posed topless and sometimes completely nude,